It was the evening of June 3rd, 1989. My wife and I were at Tiananmen Square together. The air was full of tension, full of panicky rumors, like a scent, the smell of blood, from what was about to happen. I was agitated. I was reckless. I said, I am a historian. I must observe these events. My wife disagreed. She tried to drag me home. I wouldn't go. We started arguing there right on the square. In the end, my wife said one thing that convinced me. She said, you can't just say nothing and die. You are a historian, so use your pen to tell the people the truth about these events. That statement moved me, so I agreed to leave the square. Still, in my heart, I felt shame. I couldn't hold up my head. People wearing white headbands were streaming toward the square while I was playing the deserter.
For many years, Gao Wenqian was an official historian of the late Premier Zhou Enlai, a popular leader and Mao Zedong's second-in-command, who died in 1976. Gao's job was to protect and defend the image of the man called the People's Beloved Premier. But on June 4, 1989, the government sent the army to attack a peaceful pro-democracy movement.
From that time forward, I felt divorced from the Communist Party. I'd hoped that in 1989, the party could have a dialogue with the people, could see the patriotism of the students' cry against corruption. But in the end, the government answered them with tanks. I think the greatest misery is to lose hope, so I started to work on this book.
In 2003, Gao Wenqian undercut the official picture of Zhou Enlai by publishing Zhou Enlai, the Last Perfect Revolutionary, in Hong Kong.
From the time my book was published in 2003 straight through to 2006, this book of mine was number one on the list of forbidden books.
On October 11, 1994, Random House published a new book, The Private Life of Chairman Mao, Memoirs of Mao's Personal Physician. The Chinese edition came out in Taiwan 1 week later. In their compound in Beijing, the top leaders were furious, for this book told in minute detail how the one man who more than all others had shaped and dominated the party and given life and form to the People's Republic was not the great father and guide that so many had felt him to be. The book portrayed Mao's personal life as degenerate and depraved, and his policies as cruel and lawless. To cap it all, this was the first personal testimony of a close associate of Mao published outside of China. The response came quickly. Many people who had been close to high leadership, including Wang Dongxing, former vice chairman of the party and head of its general office, attacked the doctor's memoir in open letters and even books. Such a response would hardly have been possible without high-level approval in Beijing. The reason for such a vigorous response was that the book was written by Dr. Li Zhisui, one-time head of the elite Army Hospital 305 and Mao Zedong's personal doctor for some 20 years.
He was the doctor always at Mao Zedong's side. The chairman's, basically the president's personal doctor. That means he understood every aspect of Mao's physical condition from head to toe. When Mao would come out to inspect the Red Guards, Li Zhisui rode in the same car. So you don't have to doubt his credibility.
On February 13, 1995, when The Private Life of Chairman Mao had been out for just 4 months, its author, Dr. Li Zhisui, died suddenly in his home in Chicago. His next project died with him. It was to have been a broader chronicle of the people and events he had witnessed during his many years inside the secluded compound for the highest leaders, the modern Forbidden City in the heart of Beijing. The private life of Chairman Mao and Zhou Enlai, the last perfect revolutionary, are not the only banned books shedding important new light on China's leaders. The book How Did the Red Sun Rise takes us inside the remote mountain base camp where the communist rebels regrouped in the 1930s. We read how Mao Zedong used the so-called rectification movement to eliminate enemies and solidify his personal control. A true record of the Lushan Conference describes an ugly fight for power among Communist Party leaders at a six-week conference in 1959. Prisoner of the State was recorded secretly by former premier and party head Zhao Ziyang while he was under house arrest.
On the night of June 3rd, I was taking the air with my family in our courtyard when I heard the sound of gunfire in the streets. This utterly devastating tragedy, we cannot, in the end, prevent.
One after another, such banned books have overturned the basic understanding of recent history that most Chinese people have long taken for granted. Secrets of the Korean War debunks the myth of the so-called war to resist U.S. aggression and aid Korea. This book explains that the aggressor was the North Korean leader. China's help only solidified a dynasty of ruthless dictators now in its third generation. Overt Operations uncovers the secret plans and goals that shaped the public programs of the great anti-rightist movement and purge in the late 1950s. Lhasa 1959 discusses the communist government's treatment of Tibet. Officially, from the beginning, Beijing wanted friendly cooperation with the Dalai Lama, though he chose rebellion and failed. But this book shows that Beijing had always been pushing him to leave the country.
In fact, in Lhasa in 1956, relations between the two sides began to be very strained. The Dalai Lama himself told me that he came back from India in April 1957. And when he arrived in Lhasa, he found barricades set up on roofs right across from the Jokhang Temple. What were these barricades for? To prepare for war.
Even topics that are most strictly off limits are addressed by some recent books. Tombstone remembers the 36 million who died in the three-year famine of 1958 to 1961 caused by government programs. The Great Cultural Revolution, Collective Record and Historical Truth, presents new research on the almost unimaginable social chaos and suffering of the period from 1966 to 1976. In Search of the Victims of June 4th has made a permanent record of names and stories from the Tiananmen crackdown, names and stories the government wanted to erase from all memory. Many books that end up banned are written by people of very high status, with unique access to inside information and even ugly secrets. These books carry great weight. For example, Li Rui, author of the book on the Lushan Conference, was Mao Zedong's own political secretary during the conference, as well as being a deputy minister and later an important member of the Central Committee.
Of course, Li Rui knew all about the internal doings of the party, and especially the Lushan Conference, in which he took part. He took minutes of the conference, very detailed minutes. They describe what Liu Shaoqi and Zhou Enlai said, and how they joined Mao Zedong in attacking Peng Dehuai. He used these incredibly valuable source material to write a book tracing all the twists and turns of the conference. So the book has great authority.
Zong Fengming joined the party in 1938 and was once party head for Beijing University of Aeronautics and Astronautics. His book, Zhao Ziyang, Captive Conversations, was based on his own interviews with Zhao Ziyang, head of the party during the Tiananmen crackdown. It described Zhao's life under house arrest after the incident.
Zong Fengming was Zhao Ziyang's close comrade in arms. They fought the Japanese together as guerrillas, even in their teens. When Zhao Ziyang was under house arrest, it was hard for people to visit him, and few did. But Zong Fengming could see him every day. He had a very special position. They came from the same area. They were old companions and comrades in arms, so they could speak with complete candor about many things.
Authors of banned books can come from the left or from the right. Not all of them are the sort of people who might be called dissidents. Many are even leading figures of the Marxist left, such as the famous four generals who served under Marshal Lin Biao. Another example from the left is Chen Boda, the fourth highest leader during the Cultural Revolution and a member of the Standing Committee of the Politburo. Yet another is Deng Lichun, nicknamed King of the Left, who was Minister of Propaganda and a key figure of the Central Committee until his downfall.
In Hong Kong, there's a publishing house called Strong Wind Press, run by a man named Wang Xiaoqiang. He knew Deng Lichun's son. I think that's how Deng Lichun managed to connect with a publisher in Hong Kong. After the first edition came out, of course, it attracted attention. Beijing found out right away and made sure there wouldn't be a second or third edition. The book could not be reprinted, and the copies on the market had to be recalled. The People's Republic of China, its future and its destiny are now in very serious danger.
Li Peng was premier of China for over a decade. In 1989, the whole world knew him as a hardline enemy of the democracy movement. The journal he kept in those days was to be published in Hong Kong in 2010 as Li Peng's June 4th diary. But at the last minute, pressure from Beijing led the publisher to cancel the book. Still, several editions appeared overseas. Chen Xitong was mayor of Beijing during the June 4th crackdown on the democracy movement centered in Tiananmen Square, as well as being a member of the nation's Politburo.
I met with Chen Xitong over a dozen times from January 2011 to June 2012. I took notes in 9 of the meetings, and by the end they became this book. Chen Xitong, in his own words, "The voice of the crowd cannot drown out the truth."
Secret dealings of the highest leaders. New perspectives on history and politics. Dark deeds in the halls of power. All from authors with high credibility. These forbidden books have become sizzling hot commodities.
Dr. Li Jiusui's book on Mao Zedong, among all the banned books available in Hong Kong, I think was number one. In the number sold, in the power of its influence, right down to today, I think no other book surpasses it. The very idea of banned books really made readers want to buy them. After so many years of reform and opening up, in many ways, China's freedoms are basically the same as in the West. But as for freedom of the press or of publishing here, the differences are the biggest. So when people travel to the West, aside from buying famous brand merchandise, a main item on the to-do list is buy banned books. Really, compared to buying clothes, watches, or things like that, buying forbidden books is much more exciting. This book of mine has become one of the very best gifts to bring back from overseas travel, to please your boss and show respect for officials. Many officials, I know this, ask for the book by name.
One should not underestimate the attention paid to such books by the public and in high levels of government.
My old schoolmate was a top leader. Someone told him, "Your schoolmate has published another book." The Great Chinese Famine cannot be separated from the so-called three policies: socialist construction, the Great Leap Forward, and people's communes. They created the famine.
I heard that one time Jiang Zemin was holding a meeting of the Central Military Commission, and someone told him every person at the meeting owned a copy of Dr. Li Jiusui's memoir. They say Jiang Zemin just exploded.
Still, whether it is new political perspectives, secret arrangements, or criminal deeds in the halls of power, Chinese officialdom does not want people to hear about them.
Right now, on the Chinese mainland, criticizing Mao Zedong is easy. Criticizing Zhou Enlai is hard. Why? Because for the party, Zhou Enlai is a moral saint. As for Mao, he attacked many of his own actions, so nobody else can give him a perfect image in light of what's known. But Zhou Enlai, they still hope to maintain that brand name. Toward the revolution of the party, Zhou was so faithful, so deeply honorable. The way he ended up was a tragedy, and most people just didn't know. Now, who can still believe in this so-called Chinese Communist Revolution? This really undermines the party's strength.
Yang Tisheng's book on the Great Chinese Famine, Tombstone, was reissued many times in Hong Kong, and there's an English edition in the U.S. But in the land where the tragedy occurred, half a century later, the book is still banned.
On the mainland, it certainly can't be published. I'm in the publishing business myself. How could I not know this? If I were an editor and someone gave it to me, I couldn't publish it. You have to toe the political line. In Wuhan, a local committee issued a notice to the Board of Education. Certain pornographic and reactionary books may not enter school grounds. Among them was Tombstone.
When a government has the power to ban books, it will ban them for many reasons, not just to maintain ideological correctness, but also to protect the power and privileges of the members of the ruling class.
When these books came out, they touched on many taboo areas involving many particular people, some of them still alive. Some have died, but their children and grandchildren are alive. On the mainland, these people represent power, money, and economic influence. Their family status is at the heart of it all. Poking into history might hurt their position. At the very least, they would lose face.
As Yang Tisheng wrote in an op-ed essay in the New York Times on November 13, 2012, a full exposure of the Great Famine could undermine the legitimacy of a ruling party that clings to the political legacy of Mao. That legacy, a totalitarian communist system, was the root cause of the famine. Gao Wenqian's book on Zhou Enlai made use of many internal documents. Declassifying long-sealed government documents is a first step toward openness and transparency. The authorities in China cannot allow that process to begin.
The Soviet Union's great transformation started with the beginning of glasnost, transparency. Now, historically, the Chinese Communist Party, how it treated the people and its own members, was far worse than the Russian party. Therefore, the moment a crack starts to open, the moment things start to go public, the whole legitimacy of the party will collapse.
From the beginning of the People's Republic of China, the government has always banned books, but different generations of leaders have banned different kinds of books. In the 1930s, the American journalist Edgar Snow arrived in the communist base camp in Shaanxi and soon developed friendly personal relations with many of the party's leaders, including Mao Zedong. The result was his world-famous book of 1937, Red Star Over China. The Chinese edition came out in Shanghai the following year. Readers were enthusiastic, both in China and the West, and there were many reprintings. For Western and even most Chinese readers, Edgar Snow's reporting was their first introduction to the communist leaders. His sympathetic portrayal won them many friends in China and the West. After the revolution succeeded in 1949, Snow's name was a household word in China. Mao Zedong used to call him our American friend. The communists' enemies had even tried to suppress the book for that reason. But once the communists took power, republication was delayed and delayed again. In 1960, to accompany Edgar Snow's first visit to the People's Republic, a limited edition was printed for internal distribution to officials. Not until 1979 was the ban lifted and the book made freely available to the general public after the author and most of the main figures in the book had passed away. In 1962, the novel Liu Zhidan was published in China. The main character, Liu Zhidan, was a real person, a leader in the party and the army in the 1930s. He was one of the founders of the base camp in northern Shaanxi, where the Communist Party and its army ended their long march and held out for several years against the nationalist forces. As Mao Zedong once said, northern Shaanxi saved the party center. Liu Zhidan died in battle in 1936. His sister-in-law, Li Jiantong, wrote the novel as a personal memorial, but Mao attacked the 1962 book. To oppose the party and the people by writing a novel, that's something new. He saw it as a defense of another early leader whom the party had condemned, long dead when the novel came out. Though the author had carefully checked her drafts with many officials, a special investigative committee now said the novel was the product of a vast anti-party conspiracy. 60,000 people were punished. 6,000 lost their lives. China's current president, Xi Jinping, has reason to remember. His father, Xi Zhongxun, was China's vice premier at the time, but he was charged with being part of the supposed conspiracy. Beaten, publicly humiliated, and detained, his persecution lasted 16 years. In 1989, White Snow, Red Blood was published by the Army's Press, describing the last years of combat in the communist takeover. The author, Lieutenant Colonel Zhang Zhenglong, positively portrayed Marshal Lin Biao, a one-time favorite of Mao who was condemned in 1971.
Zhang Zhenglong interviewed many people in Lin Biao's Fourth Army. He presented Lin Biao as a sort of war god, brilliant, decisive, calm, firm, and as devoted to warfare as Napoleon.
White Snow, Red Blood sold 100,000 copies in 6 months, but it displeased some of the top leaders and generals.
The first to speak out was Lin Biao's old political opponent, Peng Zhen, the chairman of the legislature. He said to the secretary, "Can Lin Biao really be greater than Mao Zedong?"
The next to speak was China's vice president, Wang Zhen.
Wang Zhen formed his hand into a gun and said, "Someone who attacks the party, attacks the revolution, and stirs up the army, why keep him around?"
The president of China at that time, Yang Shangkun, wrote a letter about the book to Jiang Zemin, who was then the general secretary of the Communist Party.
He said, "White Snow, Red Blood. I read half of it and I couldn't take it anymore. It's a vile book that praises Chiang Kai-shek and tries to rehabilitate Lin Biao."
Half a year after the People's Liberation Army published the book, it was banned and the author was detained. While White Snow, Red Blood was being published and banned, many Chinese liberal intellectuals were being jailed for their part in the democracy movement, including Dai Qing, a former journalist for the party newspaper Guangming Daily, and Bao Tong, political secretary for the former party head Zhao Ziyang.
"I got out of the vehicle and asked, 'Isn't this the famous Qincheng prison?' The three people receiving me said, 'Yes.' The first one said, 'I'm the warden.' And so I began to reside at the Qincheng political prison."
When the intellectuals were being rounded up, the General Administration of Press and Publication issued a red header document banning 14 people from publishing anything on the mainland.
It was titled Notice of Cessation of Sale of Works by Bao Tong et al. The date was September 2, 1989. At this time, Bao Tong and I both were already in jail. Its first clause was Bao Tong, Jing Guantao, Ge Yang, Su Shaozhi, Zhang Xianyang, Li Hongling, Ren Wangding, Cao Siyuan, Dai Qing, Yu Haocheng, Gao Shan, Liu Xiaobo, Wang Ruowang, Yuan Ming. Sale of these 14 people's works is hereby halted. All works whose sales halted by this announcement are strictly forbidden to be sold in any markets and strictly forbidden to be resold in any informal market. Violators will be severely punished. The relevant agencies of every locality are to intensify monitoring and control of relevant markets. Clause 6. This announcement is not public and not to be reported." Even though I am a citizen of the People's Republic of China, and even though everyone, myself, publishers, middlemen and marketers, even readers, everyone knows we have a constitution with an Article 2 with a Part 35 saying that every Chinese citizen enjoys freedom of speech and of the press. Still, my books cannot be published. I cannot write an article in a Chinese newspaper, and in principle, I cannot write an article in a magazine. Publishers are not allowed to receive my manuscripts. I cannot go to a university or any formal organization and give a talk. This is the status I occupy. On September 19, 2004, Hu Jintao became chair of the Central Military Commission. In the closing ceremonies, he gave a talk, which really amounted to his inaugural address. The topic he spoke on was the need to control ideology. Control it how? By walls and dams on every side, as though fighting floodwaters and wild beasts. Beijing purged the catalogs of three big publishers: Humanities Press, Workers' Press, and the Social Science Press. How many books were purged from these three altogether? Not many from Humanities Press. There was just an investigation of Chinese farmers, and the past is not a puff of smoke. But from the three presses together, over 70 books were stopped.
In 2008, the Chinese University of Hong Kong Press published Dai Qing's In the Palm of Buddha's Hand, Zhang Dongsun and His Era. Zhang Dongsun was a philosophy professor and a leading member of the China Democratic League, an alternative party tolerated by the communists. In 1951, he was charged with selling state secrets, stripped of his government job, and expelled from the League. In the 1960s, he was sent to prison, where he died in 1973.
I tell you, you are all in the palm of Buddha's hand. Mao Zedong himself said, "None can escape my grasp." He meant that from 1940s on, the fate of China's intellectuals had been in the palm of his own hand.
After the book came out in Hong Kong, a broker spoke with Dai Qing about a possible mainland edition.
First he asked, "Can we delete some things?" I said, "No deletions." He asked, "Can we change the title?" I said I wouldn't agree to that. Then he asked, "Can we leave your name off it?" I said, "Yes, we can." He asked, "Whose name do we use?" I said, "When I edited the collective works of Zhang Dongsun, I used my mother's name. We could just keep using her name." He was delighted. He'd already found a publisher, and the publisher had asked for the author's resume. My mother is 101 years old. We sent the resume of this 101-year-old woman. Everything was ready. But in the end, he said, "If you don't allow changes, it can't be published."
Because of the censorship in mainland China, starting in the 1980s, many authors began to set their sights on publishers in Hong Kong, Taiwan, and the United States. Hong Kong had been a British colony since 1842. Britain returned Hong Kong to China in 1997, but under a very unusual arrangement, one country, two systems, giving Hong Kong a separate government and genuine freedom of speech and press.
Hong Kong, long ago there was a time when people called it a cultural desert. They said it's only a place of tall buildings and busy businessmen.
Chinese authors whose books are banned on the mainland have continued to turn to Hong Kong. To respond to this opportunity, a number of new publishers have arisen in Hong Kong, specializing in books on mainland politics and history. Indeed, Hong Kong has become the primary location outside the mainland where books banned by the Beijing government are published.
Even Deng Lichun, whom people called King of the Left, a really high official in charge of ideology, when he later wrote his memoirs, he had to have them published in Hong Kong. Back when he was the head of the Ministry of Propaganda, he said that Hong Kong is mainly a base for publishing anti-China tracts. It's so ironic.
Once a cultural desert, Hong Kong is now known as a paradise of forbidden books. For books published on the mainland, suppression is simple. The publisher is told to stop sending the book out, and bookstores are told to take it off the shelves. But to prevent publication abroad, China must use other means. The first is to apply pressure to the author and the author's family.
For example, I mentioned Zhong Fengming. He was an old cadre with a communist pedigree going way back. As soon as his book was formally offered to our press, the Beijing authorities sought him out for a chat. Right before the scheduled publication date, they were so worried they made him go off somewhere to convalesce, so the journalists couldn't talk with him, so it wouldn't become too big a problem. In the end, a vice chair of the Commission for Science, Technology, and Industry for National Defense invited Zhong Fengming for a chat. He said, "This book you have written on Zhao Ziyang, if you did this sort of thing in the Cultural Revolution, you would be a counter-revolutionary. This book cannot be published." But he stood up to the pressure. He didn't back down. He didn't give up. If he had given up, then one phone call from him and I couldn't have published it.
2012 saw the publication of Reform Under Hu Yaobang and Zhao Ziyang, a collection of articles by an elderly former chief editor of the People's Daily, Hu Jiwei, compiled by Yao Jianfu.
This 96-year-old gentleman had been in the party for 75 years. He said, "Looks like it's time to go back to Mao Zedong's promise from the 1940s. Get rid of the single party, the single philosophy, the single leader." And the old man added, "The one-party army's fascist government." He wanted to throw out the one-party dictatorship. This book was published in January of 2012. In September 2011, a high official responsible in press and publishing went to the unit that issues my salary and also got my immediate supervisor to call me in for a chat and say, "Yao Jianfu, you have a book you're planning to publish in Hong Kong, to be published by Bao Tong Sun. Well, you can't publish it." My reply was, "I'm not the author. It says right here, Hu Jiwei, author. Yao Jianfu, compiler. I don't have the power to decide whether it gets published, but I am a party member. So if you in the higher levels want me to pass along some message, I am happy to pass along, exactly as is, whatever you want me to give to the author or the press. But just to make sure things are clear, I would like you to give me a written document saying who forbids the publication and why. Then I'll gladly pass it along." They faithfully passed my suggestion up to their superiors. Later they came back and said, "How can we put it in writing? If we put it in writing, can't Hu Jiwei then say we are violating his freedom of expression?" The second time we spoke, they said, "If this book comes out, we'll go by the old maxim. Eliminate smut and smash crime. It will be a criminal publication. Yao Jianfu is hereby forbidden from giving, promoting, or distributing anything whatsoever on behalf of Hu Jiwei."
The essayist and critic Yu Jie has written several books displeasing to officials. He must now live far from his homeland.
After I came to America, they had no way of directly threatening or intimidating me. They could only turn to my family still in China. For example, they set up a special task force. This task force, internal security agents, flew all the way from Beijing to my old family home in Sichuan. They spoke to my mother, my brother, my aunt, and other family members, asking them all to apply pressure on me.
Pressure applied to authors by state security and internal security police has become a common occurrence.
When President Hu Jintao took office in 2004, this change was very plain to see. The limits very suddenly tightened. Interference with news publishing used to come just from the party propaganda department and the General Administration of Press and Publication, that kind of agency. But now even state security and internal security police, the organs of violent force, came to interfere directly.
Yu Jie once tried to reason with the police to oppose this sort of pressure.
"The first time I had any dealings with them was in the winter of 2004, when Hu Jintao became chair of the military commission and basically took complete power. I told them if the propaganda department came to speak with me, I'd be willing to speak with them to discuss which of my views was mistaken, which of my books had a problem. But the authorities sent the police to talk with me. I said I was not willing to talk to that sort of agency. Your job, your assignment, is to protect the security of people's lives and property. I am an unarmed scholar, an author. For a department like you to come and have a conversation with me is highly improper. This only shows the absurdity of Chinese society, this kind of trampling on the rule of law.
But the police response was violence.
For the crime of inciting the overthrow of the government, they gave me a summons and brought me to the police station. They used naked threats to intimidate me, saying, "If you publish this book, we'll throw you into prison." After they bound me, took me outside the city and beat me brutally. They even said flat out, "One phone call from a superior, and in half an hour, we can dig a hole and bury you," and so on. In Hu Jintao's time, the control of news and publishing became part of maintaining social stability by brute force. Aside from the traditional means of control, the administration of Hu Jintao and Wen Jiabao added the use of state security and internal security, even to the point of using cruel physical torture, very cruel torture. That's the main reason why, in the end, I felt I had no safety, no security for my life, and I had no choice but to leave China and come to America.
Yao Jianfu helped Beijing Mayor Chen Xitong prepare a memoir of the Tiananmen affair. The book was scheduled for publication in Hong Kong on June 1st, 2012. At the last minute, the mainland police scrambled.
On May 31st, I think it was internal security. Yes, public security sent out four armies. The first army, on the morning of the 31st, went to Chen Xitong and asked him to say he had not given me permission to publish the book. The second army came to lean on me. Along with my unit leader, five or six officials came to talk with me, demanding that I email the publisher, Bao Pu, telling him to put the book under wraps, Chen Xitong in his own words. I said, "Number one, you people have not read the book, and now you ask me to block it? You are violating the party line. Seek truth from facts." I said, "Chen Xitong still thinks the Tiananmen crackdown stopped chaos from breaking out. He was against social disorder." I said, "Why wouldn't you want this kind of book to come out? Have you read it or not?" That's number one. Number two, blocking the book of a Hong Kong publisher is improper. It's one country, two systems. How can we give orders to them to ban a book? But the officials wouldn't go. They demanded that I write the email, and my unit leader urged me to think about writing it. I said, "I'll think about it for an hour." I thought for a while. I thought maybe I should do it, since otherwise they wouldn't go. In the end, I said, I agreed to write it, from our office to Bao Pu's office, saying the book should be temporarily delayed, and any losses would be borne by my unit. Then I went straight to Bao Tong's house. In Bao Tong's house, I found the Third Army, pressuring Bao Tong, saying, "You must phone your son, Bao Pu, and tell him to stop this book." Bao Tong's phone wasn't allowed to dial foreign numbers, so one of the public security people used his cell to call Bao Pu, and Bao Pu phoned Bao Tong. Bao Pu's reply was, "It's too late. On the 26th and 27th, I sent the book out to retailers, and I can't get all the copies back." That was the Third Army, still in Beijing. The Fourth Army actually went to Hong Kong to put it all under wraps or have us buy it back or whatever. Bao Pu said, "There's no way. They're already in the stores. But I have 1,000 copies here in the warehouse. These 1,000 copies you can take." They took them. Four armies went out in one day, all in a hurry, but it was too late. The next day, June 1st, Hong Kong and the whole world knew. The main content was reported by the big news agencies.
Even outside the mainland, writers and publishers often feel the grip of Beijing's growing power.
I also knew some people who very secretly, I mean very secretly, smuggled a manuscript to us. But public security or state security knew about it. They summoned the author to the station to have a cup of tea, as they say. It doesn't matter whether I am in China or in the United States. As soon as I talk to a Hong Kong press or a Taiwan press about publishing a book, while that process is underway, the party's intelligence system knows immediately. I believe that my email, my telephone, even in the United States, are not completely private and secure. They go right to Hong Kong publishers and apply direct pressure, like New Century Press, which published my Wen Jiabao, China's top movie star, and Liu Xiaobo, a biography. When Bao Pu, the owner of the press, went from Hong Kong to Beijing to visit his father Bao Tong, these internal security officers went to talk to him, to get him to drop his plan to publish this kind of book. They even went so far as to send emails with viruses to that company's officers to destroy their computers. These things actually happened. I'm sure they have their intelligence networks. Say, if there's a book we haven't decided whether to publish it, they know we're going to publish it. For example, Gao Wenqian's book, Zhou Enlai, The Last Perfect Revolutionary. I had just met with Gao Wenqian for the first time and hadn't quite decided whether to publish his book. But the security officer still came to me, took me out for a meal, and said I had best not publish that book. The Chinese consulate telephoned me, someone from the consulate in New York, to ask me to come and talk. They wanted to pay me to drop the book.
Yet despite all the tools Beijing employs to suppress books outside China, the books continue to be published.
We can't be ruled by this kind of pressure and stop publishing. Instead of pressuring us, they should open up. As long as you don't allow freedom of the press, there will have to be people like us. If mainland China allows press freedom, then our kind of overseas publishing house will disappear. We might go back to China. We might retire. We might stop publishing. The whole reason for people like us is that China doesn't have freedom of the press, freedom of publishing.
In the preface to The Private Life of Chairman Mao, Dr. Li Zhisui wrote,
Starting in
1954, when I was appointed Mao's personal physician, I wrote down some of the events I witnessed in a journal. After a while, I developed the habit of writing a full account of what I observed each day. In the latter half of 1966, the Red Guards began to search the houses of their political enemies. My wife was terrified. If they found and took my 40-odd volumes of notes, we could expect no mercy. We had to burn the notes right away. In 1976, after Mao died and the Gang of Four were arrested, my wife often said to me with regret, "What a pity. If we had kept those notes, nothing would likely have happened." She constantly urged me to record again what I had seen in those early years. In February of 1988, she was diagnosed with chronic kidney failure. On January 12, 1989, she passed away. Before she fell into a coma, she urged me again and again to write up the events I had encountered in the 39 years since the revolution. She said, "You must write this for yourself, for me, and for the generations that will come after us. I am sorry I cannot help you anymore." Behind the book, Zhou Enlai, The Last Perfect Revolutionary, lay another painful farewell.
In the 60s, my mother was labeled an active counter-revolutionary. They said she wanted to attack the working class. She was in Qincheng prison for 7 years. When she came out, she was suffering from schizophrenia. To stop my book, they told me,
Your mother had such hardship at that time. We would hate to see her suffer again. Of course, this sort of warning was very powerful. In those days, my mother suffered very terribly indeed. As a son, I was not able to be perfectly filial in her final years. As the Chinese say, when your parents are alive, do not travel far. But I was overseas. There was nothing I could do. When my mother was very ill, I faced a very hard choice: to go back to China and see my mother one last time, or to stay here and publish the book. I spoke to her on the phone. She was already gravely ill. It was leukemia. She was in the Beijing hospital. My mother told me not to worry about her. The things you know, you should tell the people. This is the task God has given you. So, in the end, I didn't even get to see my mother's face one last time. This is the great regret of my life.
More than 2,500 years ago, the great historian of the state of Qi gave his life for the cause of historical truth, and his brothers followed his example. Not long after, the Greek philosopher Socrates gave his life, condemned by a jury of his peers in democratic Athens for challenging popular views. Much ancient and modern blood has been shed for the right to speak and write without restraint, no matter how revolutionary the ideas. The first great age of Chinese philosophy ended when the emperor burned the books and buried the scholars. The beginning of printing in Europe was quickly followed by the systematic suppression of books that threatened the authority of the church. People of courage in every generation have defied censorship and paid a heavy price. In 1948, the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights proclaimed, "Everyone has the right to freedom of opinion and expression." In China, Article 35 of the Constitution has long stated, "Citizens of the People's Republic of China enjoy freedom of speech and of the press." But these are words on a page. They can never become reality without the brave and determined efforts of the writers and publishers of China's forbidden books.
Presents the following National Geographic program as we continue to explore the world around us.
I had no idea that something so gorgeous could be causing such harm on our native reef ecosystems. Lionfish are what is known as an invasive species. They can produce 2 million eggs over the course of 1 year and are voracious predators. They're essentially like the Hoover vacuums of the sea. When I was 17, I was diving off the coast of South Florida and I saw the most beautiful fish I had ever seen. It had these bold stripes and these big dramatic spines and I had no idea what it was. So I went to the dive master and he told me I had just seen a lionfish. And I was hooked. I started reading everything I could about this strange and beautiful fish, and what I found completely astounded me. I had no idea that something so gorgeous could be causing such harm on our native reef ecosystems. Lionfish are what is known as an invasive species, and that's defined as a species that is non-native to its area and that is causing harm or is likely to cause harm. Now, lionfish are originally from the Indo-Pacific region, and they were introduced off the coast of South Florida in the mid-1980s. And most likely it was through an aquarium release, so someone who had some pet lionfish didn't want to take care of them anymore, and then just dumped them into the local waterways. So this is problematic for a couple reasons. First, lionfish are prolific breeders. They can produce 2 million eggs over the course of 1 year, and one lionfish and all of her offspring can produce 8.1 quintillion eggs in just 3 months. And the other thing is they are voracious predators. They're essentially like the Hoover vacuums of the sea. They can eat anything up to half their size. And unfortunately, that includes a lot of the really cool, interesting reef fish that we like to see on the reef as divers. To top it all off, they have a series of venomous spines lining their back. This produces a very nasty neurotoxin that causes pain and swelling if you're stung. One of my interviewees told me that it won't kill you, but it'll make you wish you were dead. So this is definitely not a fish that we want wandering around where it doesn't belong. And the more I read about this fish, the more I realized that there was a lot of talk about the biology and ecology of lionfish, but really was no one was diving into the kind of social implications of this fish. So I went to South Florida, and I found this incredible community that has completely rallied around the removal of this species using whatever resources they have at their disposal. For example, you have Bob and Maria Hickerson. They're located in South Florida, and they would go in their free time and try and remove as many lionfish as possible on their local reefs. But they were getting so frustrated because they were leaving so many fish behind. So they took some tools and random things they found at Home Depot and created the very first lionfish-specific spear gun. So now you can remove them at a much faster rate. And then Maria takes the spines and the fins and creates really beautiful pieces of lionfish jewelry. She then sells them to support the removal initiatives, but also raise awareness about lionfish as an invasive species. You also have people like Mike Ryan, who is a dive instructor in Key Largo, and he was scared to see the increasing number of lionfish off his reefs, but what was even more disconcerting was how many people were coming through his dive shop who had no idea what lionfish were and why they were a problem. So he created a lionfish safari hunter course where you can actually learn how to remove lionfish safely and effectively and then go out and do your own lionfish hunting dive. So, of course, I had to try, and I'm actually taking what I learned and teaching you all today so you, too, can become lionfish hunters. So I have a subject. Oh, geez. Okay. It was a test. Okay, so this is Larry the lionfish. He came with me on all my travels. And here are the tools you need to become a lionfish hunter. You have a pole spear, which is a three-pronged spear. There's other larger ones, but this is the travel size. And you have a puncture-proof medical-grade glove. And so this is to ensure that you don't get stung by a lionfish and run into problems with your dive. So lionfish have no natural predators, so they allow you to get really close, which is why this spear works on lionfish, but not lots of the other types of fish in the reef. So you find your lionfish, you get all close, and then you pull this very tight rubber band to create the tension, and then you sneak up and you have your lionfish. So there you go, there's dinner. So now you know what to do when you encounter a lionfish in the wild. Okay, what's next? So the great thing about lionfish is that they're actually delicious to eat. And that's something that John Mirabella, who lives in Marathon Key, found out for himself. He would go out and remove lionfish in the morning and take it back to the restaurant he owned on Marathon and just experiment with all different types of recipes. So here's lionfish sushi, which I tried and it was delicious. And then I did run out of food money. I spent it all on diving. I have my priorities really messed up. And so I ended up eating lionfish for almost every meal for like 2 weeks. Which is totally barbaric, but it was delicious. And the great thing is that in John's restaurant, he marketed that he was serving lionfish in the local newspapers, and people were coming from all over the Keys to sample this fish, which shows that even if people are removing them themselves, they're excited to support initiatives that are. So then my problem was, you know, how do I tell these incredible stories of the people doing this grassroots management? I started with a website. I posted blogs and articles and photo galleries and whatnot. But I also had the opportunity to blog for National Geographic, which was one of the coolest things I've ever done. But the best part about it was when those blogs would get picked up by the social media channels. All of a sudden, my piece is getting tweeted out to millions and millions of people, and then something truly incredible would happen. We'd spark this online discussion about lionfish and about invasive species. And I had people saying all kinds of stuff like, wow, I had no idea they were so invasive. Or, did they really taste that good? Or, I can't believe you're removing this beautiful fish, you crazy. Like, I literally had everything. I had everything. everything under the sun people say. And to be honest, I didn't care what they were saying. What mattered to me was that they were having that conversation. Invasive species are a massive problem around the world, and it's just not something that many people know about. In United States alone, 42% of the species that are listed as threatened or endangered are at risk due to invasive species. So this is something that we can't ignore. So I just got back from the Millennial Trains Project, which was a cross-country train journey from LA to DC, where I looked at invasive species management throughout the American South. This guy was in New Orleans. He was quite a character. He uses invasive nutria and invasive Asian carp on his menu and also includes an educational component so people can learn about what they're eating. Then I was in San Antonio looking at a group of people who, in their free time, organize volunteer groups to go remove invasive weeds. This particular weed is called cat's claw vine, and it has a series of very, very sharp thorns. And to demonstrate that, my guide threw it at me to see how it would stick to my shirt. And it did, and it hurt. So that's some of the fun things you get into in the field. My next trip takes me to Fiji, and there I'm looking specifically at what they're doing right. So Fiji has one of the best examples of community-based invasive species management in the world. They do an amazing job at engaging the local community, not only in removal, but teaching them how to do long-term monitoring. It's not enough just to sweep in and remove a bunch of species and leave. You really need to know what to look for in the future and how to prevent the invasions from ever happening. So this whole project started as me seeing a fish that I thought looked really cool. But the deeper I dive into invasive species management, the harder it is for me to step away. I've learned not only how many people have been affected by the species, but how many people have stepped up to the plate and helped defend their communities and homes. So I encourage you to follow along, to go back to your home and go back to your community and learn what is invasive in your community. Not only what it is, how to identify it, but what you can do about it. Are there any removal initiatives that you can volunteer and take part in? Because this is something that we can just cannot handle if we try and do it in these little isolated communities. Everyone has to have a stake in this and participate and help defend your homes and communities from invaders. Thanks, all.
VOA, exploring the world around us. Welcome to English at the Movies, where we teach you American English heard at the movies. Today's expression is make things right from the film Nine Lives. This is a funny story about a billionaire businessman who spends little time with his family. He becomes trapped inside the body of a pet cat. Listen for the phrase, make things right.
How did I get into this?
You haven't been there for your family. You're going to be stuck inside this cat until you make things right.
Seriously?
What is the meaning of the phrase, make things right? Fix something that is wrong or make dinner tonight? Listen again. Did you get it right?
How did I get into this?
You haven't been there for your family. You're going to be stuck inside this cat until you make things right.
Seriously?
Make things right means to fix something that is wrong. In the movie, the man is turned into the family cat so that he would have to spend more time with his wife and daughter. He was given a chance to make things right, to change his behavior and return to being a human again. And that is English at the Movies. I'm Ann Ball.
Please. I think this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship.